Welcome to Portrait of a Londoner. Today, we're talking to Amina Hassan, who is a psychotherapist in private practice after a long career in the NHS. And Amina is also my sister. We start by asking her how she approaches the treatment of depression from a psychotherapist's perspective.
You know, I always think that depression is connected to some kind of loss, whether it's a tangible loss. You've lost, you know, a person. You've lost a job or home or something like that. Or whether it's an abstract loss, you know, that you feel that you have lost your sense of self. That you've lost your confidence. I use that as one of the models. But I also use, that depression can come at a time of transition, a transition point in life, or a point in the life cycle. So, you know, when change has happened, you know, after you become a mother those points of change. And I try and normalize that, through the work, I try and normalize what it is to be human, that human sadness and human fear and human anxiety are part of what it is to be human. I look at the beliefs and attitudes that are at the root of depression. You know, maybe people have a distorted view of self. You know, I must be good at everything I take on. Or, you know, unless I'm doing something useful in my life, I'm worthless. Mm. That kind of thing. Because sometimes, you know, a person might have worked in the job for 30 years and they lose their job and they feel that their life has no meaning. Beliefs like, you know, I can't be happy because I'm on my own. So I try and look at beliefs and attitudes, the distorted view of self. I go and look at, you know, early trauma. The root of early trauma, maybe in the depression, maybe there's been sexual abuse. I look at beliefs that people have about themselves, their parenting. So as a family therapist, I would do something called a genogram, which is a family tree. And I might do a three generational family tree. So I look at beliefs that have been passed down. Might not be helpful. For example, this is how family should be. Men should be this way. You know, a man has to be tough or competent or whatever, and a woman has to be this way. So I look at these beliefs that may be maybe not helpful. I look at issues around shame, because, you know, that's always connected sometimes to depression. Impossible expectations that people might have that have come from their family of origin. You know, I must always get straight A's, or I'm a failure because I didn't get a first, or, you know, those sort of expectations that people have about themselves that set them up for failure.
Can I just ask, from a really kind of practical point of view, how can understanding your family dynamic, how can that, or early, your early environment, how can that help you if you are depressed to move forward? What are the pieces that you might learn that can help you in your recovery?
We all come from families, and, you know, we don't live in isolation. Sometimes the way that we've been raised can have an impact on our current relationships, on our, you know, with our children, with our partners, that kind of thing. Family beliefs that people have can, you know, really can affect, you know, sort of, you know, sort of, there are family myths or beliefs that people hold, that they've carried, that are connected to, or family secrets that people have kept. You know, people come and, you know, sort of share with me that, you know, I've when I was 8 years old, this happened. I've never shared this with anyone. I was sexually abused. You know, this is the first time I'm sharing it. You know, you make connection. You know, we're part of families and we're part of, and we, you know, the other thing I look at is family scripts, you know, that have been passed down from families. And, you know, so, you know, as people, what we need to look at our family scripts and sort of decide what's relevant and what's not.
Looking at your current relationships through the prism of mm-hmm. your early relationships, mm-hmm. so reevaluating mm-hmm. your current behaviour and relationships, and then also maybe choosing to discard some of the behaviours that are kind of entrenched, and actually mm-hmm. making that decision of, actually, this doesn't really work for me right yeah. now.
Even, and some of the beliefs.
Yeah, yeah. And some of the beliefs. So yeah. kind of questioning your inherited beliefs and behaviours.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Also, you know, I look at things like, you know, sometimes people come and they've got issues with anger, and it's not really about anger. It's really about sadness or depression. And sometimes anger can mask other things. Also, there's something, you know, depression sometimes is a signal that, you know, a major change needs to happen. You've lived this way for so long and it's not worked, and, you know, things need to change. So that's also another.
And that can take years, can't it?
To get to. Because we hold on to these beliefs that are, or ideas of who we are that really don't belong anymore.
Yeah.
You know, I must be this way in the world.
And it's almost like a questioning of everything you've believed to be true.
Yes.
About your own, you know, makeup, and, you know, it's like dismantling all of that is very difficult.
It is.
It's very, very difficult.
It is.
There's still lots of stigma around accessing around mental health and accessing therapy. Mm-hmm. How can we help to break down some of this?
I think really, how can we break down the stigma around mental health education? Sort of.
Because I know, even personally, like, you know, we don't talk about in our own family where, you know, any mental health struggles or any, you know, it's like your physical health, isn't it?
It comes in and out of it.
It's not, but it's not normalised that way.
You know, we don't.
It's not like that yet.
No. And in many families, you know, it's okay to sort of deal with physical problems rather than mental health problems. I think, you know, look at your beliefs around mental health, you know, rethink them. I think, you know, people don't access mental health services because sometimes services are not very engaging or very welcoming, and can be even hostile, particularly to people from you know, sort of black and ethnic minorities. And there is a fear of accessing therapy because people don't have an understanding of it. Mm. You know, will I be sectioned if I go and have therapy? That kind of thing. You know. Mm. You know, people will say, "I'm not mad."
Yeah,
and I say, "Yeah, you're not. You're struggling with depression. You're struggling with anxiety, or you're struggling with relationship problems." Mm. There's real fear around being labelled. I mean, sometimes people have the wrong view. You know, I remember, you know, some GPs would say to me, "Oh, they're very resilient, these people. You know, they've got a community." You know, when I asked about, well, why are people from this group not being referred? Oh, they're very resilient. They've got their own community.
They're self-sufficient.
Yeah. Or they're very strong. They're very resilient. That kind of thing.
But they're human beings. Yeah. It's that inheritance of like being stoic or like being like, I think that's, strong and all of that stuff.
Yeah. And I think in many families, that's really prevalent. Mm. That's really prevalent, you know, to be stoical and to, you know, and to sort of, you know, be strong and not ask for help, you know, get on with life. And it's also connected to, I think, a lot of families have this, but also it's connected to migration. Mm. You know, people, you know, our father migrated just after the war, you know, and, you know, that generation, you know, you got on with life. You didn't sort of look, you don't look too deeply at things. You just sort of carried on, really.
Yeah, yeah. Certainly for Abba's generation, you know, approaching anything like, you know, seeking therapy or talking about to somebody about, you know, your issues, it just wasn't on there.
No. It wasn't on the on their radar. And I remember talking to my father about what I did, and, you know, sort of he was quite perplexed, and he said, "Well, why can't these people solve their own problems? Why do they have to come to you?"
Faith has played a big role in both of our lives, and in this section we talk to Amina about the role of faith and in her work. Faith is really important to you, and it's helped me navigate a lot of loss.
Yes,
and,
yes.
You know,
yes.
And it's the thing that's kind of kept me going, I think, you know, in lots of ways.
Yeah.
Because it gives you something to hold on to in very, very difficult and challenging times.
It does. But also what faith does is that it tells you, you know, how the world is. Mm. That the world is a place of anxiety, that the world is a place of sadness, that it's light and shade, and that's normal, and that every human being will suffer some kind of pain in their lives, and that's okay.
Yeah, and I suppose it just so happened that we experienced that very young. And,
yes, that's very true.
But yeah, it's making sense of the world. It helps me make sense of the world.
Yes, yes. And me too. It does. Yeah. And it normalizes things as well.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, absolutely.
That you know, that death is inevitable, that we have to live with uncertainty, that, you know, we only have today.
Yeah, yeah.
That kind of thing.
Well, another thing that's happened this week is I don't know if you saw Amina, the Sainsbury's adverts that were launched for Christmas.
Oh yes,
and,
yes.
Actually, what one of them was, it was a series of lovely adverts. Actually, one of which was featured a black family, an all black family, and it provoked a lot of really negative and really some awful commentary on social media. I actually remember watching it and thinking, this is wonderful. What a lovely advertisement. But then I read the Twitter commentary and it was, you know, how do people cope with that constant wave of racism that you're presented with? I know it's no surprise. I'm not surprised by it, but it's that it's in the media so much. It's almost like you're hit with it again and again. How do people cope with that? And maybe some feelings of helplessness that they may have about this.
Yeah, yeah. You know, it can feel, you know, you see something like that and you think, oh, this is so positive and we've come a long way.
Beautiful, yeah.
And then you think, oh, no, we're going back in time. Because I grew up, a long time ago and it was that racism was, I mean, it's more subtle now, but it was more sort of overt when I was growing up, you know, and we're sort of moving back to that, to those times again. And, you know, that I think Twitter is sort of problematic because there are people out there who can say whatever they want without any repercussions, you know, they can hide themselves, you know, and it is very difficult. It is very difficult.
Yeah, it's almost, you can jump on there and say what you like without knowing what the consequences of that could be on somebody.
Exactly, you know? how that impacts on someone.
Yeah, you can be quite strong in your... in your...
And you will say those things, you know, openly, you know, to another person.
You can hide behind a handle. How do we manage our own mental health with some of this? Because
to talk about it, what you're doing now, talk about it to your family, to your friends, to go for therapy. You know, I've had people call me and say, look, I'm not depressed. I'm not depressed. I'm not anxious. I'm just, seeing George Floyd die. Watching that video has really impacted me. It's made me really angry. It's made me really sad. I just want to talk about these things. Yeah. I don't talk about. Yeah. Yeah, I don't have.
Yeah, and accessing it in that kind of way, not seeing it as something that, you know, I have to have a real serious, some really serious issues to, I'm not saying not serious issues, but I can come and go to into therapy and out of therapy.
Exactly. And you can come just for a few sessions. Yeah. You can just come for a few sessions and say, this is what I want to process, what's going on.
Yeah.
It's really having an impact on me. I'm really angry. I don't know how to focus. I don't know where to sort of channel my anger. But get involved in groups, get involved in unions.
I think that's a really interesting point that you just made there, because I think some people, and definitely I would be in this camp, might perceive therapy as some a long ongoing.
No.
But the fact that you can access it just for even one or two sessions.
Yes, very much so. Very much so.
That's a really kind of good reminder, actually. You don't have to keep going.
No. And sometimes I see people for a few sessions, maybe I'll see them for six sessions, and they've made some progress in that. And I will say, look, why don't you just go away and see how things are, but come back if things prove too difficult. Yeah. And when I was in the NHS, I used to give them, we used to call them sessions in the bank. So I'd say, right, I'm going to give you four sessions in the bank that you can access anytime in the next 6 months or the next year.
Do you think people can kind of use that in a way of, because obviously there's the overt stuff that's in your face, but there's also the kind of microaggressions and things that you might be dealing with in your life on a day, you know, that are, they're not smaller by any means, but they are happening.
Speak out about these microaggressions. If someone, you know, if someone is rude or aggressive, you know, sort of, you know, speak out about them, speak to your family, get involved in organizations that are, you know, get involved with movements.
There's lots of
there'll be other like-minded people. You know, you'll put up a good fight and you'll sort of work hard and but you won't succeed. You know, or you'll hold on really tightly to something and it doesn't, you have to let it go. Someone once said, acceptance is a small, quiet room. You know, sometimes, you know, we have to live with, you know, this is how life is. We're in COVID. We don't know how long COVID's going to be around. There's a vaccine. Will this vaccine, you know, is it going to work? Is it not going to work? Is it going to be a yearly thing? Do we have to be vaccinated every year? You know, we don't know. There has to be a level of acceptance, and it's really hard. I mean, you know, these are difficult times. Try and see the situation has, you know, try and see your reaction has quite normal to these, you know, abnormal time that we're living in. And try and sort of manage your stress, manage your worry, and this is the reality that, you know, this is the reality we're living in. I don't like it. You don't like it. But this is where we have to start from.
I have read somewhere, and I've not tried this myself, but some people during COVID have found it helpful to restrict themselves in terms of the time limit they'll allow themselves to worry. I don't, just from a psychotherapist.
Oh, yes. I've used that time limit.
Okay,
yeah,
I'm going to allow myself to worry, but after 8 p.m. or between 8 p.m.
Yeah,
8 p.m.
exactly.
I'm going to watch TV, or I'm going to do something. I'm not going to worry. Yeah. You think that's helpful?
I've used it for people pre-COVID, or, you know, give yourself a half hour or an hour, a worry hour, and then you can worry about everything, you know. I say to people, worry about what, you know, everything that you want to worry about, the world, you know, anything that's going on in your life, but you can only worry in that space. Sometimes it's helpful for some people, sometimes it's not helpful for others, you know. It just depends.
Gosh, yeah, for me, I don't think I could. I'm one of those people who it's always bubbling. If I've got some worries, I can't contain that to,
yeah, yeah,
you know. a time.
Maybe
I need to try it.
Maybe think about, I mean, it's you know, it's something that works for some people, it doesn't work for others.
Absolutely.
It's like sort of putting your worries in a box kind of thing, and or giving your worries to, like, the religious people might give their worries to God, or you give your worries to the universe, you know, that kind of thing. But we will worry and we will be anxious, because life is difficult and it's painful, and we are living in really painful times.
People do just need an outlet for it, don't they? Somewhere to go, you know, if that's through prayer and your faith,
or through nature,
your friends,
you know, going for a walk and seeing, you know, beautiful things, you know, the sky and the trees. And
I suppose it's why walking has really helped with, you know, my mental health, just being able to, you know, get out, be alone for a little bit of time, get out in nature and just keep walking, so that I can, you know, that's helped me a great deal.
And one final question. Who inspires you in the world of psychotherapy and why?
There are so many people that inspire me, and I don't want to sort of give you a long list of people. There are two family therapists who inspire me, David Epstein and Michael White. Michael White has died, and he was an Australian, and David Epstein is from New Zealand. And I've seen them both. They came over, and David Epstein came over in 2017, and I saw Michael White in around 2000, I think. And they have a sort of a model called narrative therapy, where you look at, you look at people's narratives of their lives, or this, all the stories they tell themselves about themselves, or the stories that they privilege. And they usually, these stories are usually problem saturated. So someone will say, I'm a depressive, I'm a paranoid schizophrenic, I'm bipolar, I'm a depressive, that kind of thing. And they sort of looked at ways of looking for the hidden stories, the subjugated stories that people do not privilege and do not talk about. So finding ways. And the other thing they did was something called externalizing the problem, which I use a lot, which is separating the person from the problem. You have depression, you know, you have bipolar, you have a diagnosis of paranoid schizophrenia, but this is not you. I found them very interesting. I use that model, and I find it very interesting. I've also been inspired by the people the people who trained me, whether it was at Goldsmiths College or at Birkbeck or at the Institute of Family Therapy. My clinical supervisors over the years in the NHS have been very, very inspirational.
So if people want to find out more about you or connect with you for therapy, how can they find you?
They can email me at psychotherapy.associatesuk, associatesuk is one word, @gmail.com.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Really lovely talking to you.
Yes, it's been a pleasure.